Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we'll be looking at the final Brexit war amongst the Conservatives. We'll also be looking at the maverick politician taking Ukraine by storm. And finally, we'll be getting on the blower with blowers. In this week's issue, James Forsyth says that the Tories' latest titanic battle over Europe has just begun. James joins me now, along with Henry Newman, the director of Open Europe. So James, in your piece, you say that Theresa May has to now make a decision between these two options. What are they?
I think within government, there are two arguments what the nature of Britain's relationship with the EU should be. I think Philip Hammond, the Institutional Treasury, Jeremy Hayward, they're all very drawn to this idea that you could call EEA-. That is essentially not being in the single market, but being as close to it as possible. I think everyone accepts that the referendum result means that single market membership is off the table because it requires accepting free movement. What this scheme would see is the UK do everything else it could to stay in regulatory alignment with the EU's internal market in the hope for as frictionless as possible access to it. Then you've got the other position kind of advocated by the kind of Michael Gove and Boris Johnson stuff as well, which is actually what you want with the EU is a trade deal. And they look to the kind of EU-Canada free trade agreement as more of a model. I mean, they'd like to add a few things onto it, but they basically think that the crucial thing is that Britain is kind of free to chart its own course, that it doesn't have to march in lockstep with the EU's regulatory framework.
Henry, what do you make of these two options?
Well, I think these are the options that are being discussed inside government. They're sometimes used, slightly different terms are used to describe them. They talk about high access, low control, which would be the sort of EEA minus option that James just described, or higher control, low access, which is more towards the sort of Canada side. So I think we can imagine this spectrum of options from a sort of Norway-Switzerland relationship. And as James says, the conclusion inside government is that sort of direct single market relationship is impossible. We have to be just the other side of that line for some people, like for some institutions within government, the Treasury, areas of the civil service. But others would argue that we need to be quite a long way down towards Canada. And I've also heard James, I think, is right to say that certain civil servants and the institution of the Treasury are very in favour of this EEA minus option. But I've heard from other civil servants at senior levels in other departments that they recognise that we need to be further towards Canada, further away from the single market to get some of those benefits of Brexit. And the real point is that when Open Europe looked at this, the question of Brexit before the referendum, we saw that really Brexit itself would not necessarily have a particularly huge impact on the economy. The likely range of impact that we modelled was something between minus 0.8 and plus 0.6% of GDP by 2030. So relatively small. So these decisions are important, but ultimately we're arguing about a relatively small range of economic impact.
James, do we have any sense of which side Theresa May is going to go down on?
I think at the weekend, there was real nervousness amongst the Brexiteers that she was going down the EEA minus path. I mean, that is, I think, one of the things that led to Boris Johnson's essay in The Telegraph appearing on Friday night. I mean, there was a real fear that they were losing the argument. And I think the EEA minus crowd had their tails up. And I think they were very happy when it was announced that Ollie Robbins was going to go and work in number 10. He's very close to Theresa May. They work together at the Home Office. And he is a big advocate of this EEA minus approach. And that was taken as a sign that she was going to be steered down that path. I think the pushback from Boris Johnson and Michael Gove has succeeded in meaning that the Florence speech isn't going to indicate that that is where the UK is heading. But this debate in government remains unresolved. And I think this is the important point, which is the clock is ticking on Article 50. And then I think to refer to something else Henry's been talking about, there's another question, which is what do we want to do after Brexit? And this is the point. One of the arguments I would make as to why EEA minus is a bad idea is we want to be able to do different things on medical research. We want to take a different attitude to technology and data than the EU. All of those things, I think, would boost our economy, be good for Britain, but would be impossible under an EEA minus model because we'd have to carry on doing just what the EU does, essentially.
And both of these options, I mean, presumably are only in play if the EU decides to go for it. I mean, do we know whether they're going to accept?
I think this is fascinating. I'm called up someone who has Brexit department who has the ear of David Davis, who is definitely on the more Eurosceptic side of the spectrum. He basically said, oh, don't worry about EEA minus, because the EU will never accept it without free movement, and free movement is a non-starter. I mean, too often we forget in this debate that we kind of take the view that kind of once the Tory party has finally worked out what it wants, that's the relationship we'll get, when actually that's the start of the negotiation, which again I think is another argument for going more towards the Canada model Because the closer you want to get to the internal market, the more the EU is able to ask for in exchange for that.
So I think one of the slightly depressing things about this situation is that these questions are only just beginning to be seriously discussed inside government. We have obviously seen since the general election, which set the Prime Minister's majority back significantly and weakened her, a shifting power dynamic inside the cabinet. And I think the cabinet needs to be more muscular in asserting itself. And we've seen some of that. We've seen the Treasury back as a major power player in Whitehall. I mean, although I disagree with a lot of Philip Hammond's direction on his Brexit policy, it's good that the Treasury is a sort of serious power player. Equally, I think what we've seen this week is both David Davis and Boris in separate ways setting out, well, last week, setting out their sort of, or stretching out their elbows a bit and sort of pushing their departments to do a bit more. But the cabinet does need to debate this. The cabinet needs to consider these ideas, face up to the fact that moving towards Canada will come with some costs as a model, but also further opportunities. Now, we don't need to necessarily say all this publicly, but the cabinet does need to have something in mind when the Prime Minister and David Davis and officials are going into a negotiation. And they certainly need to make sure that they don't close off options in the speech that the Prime Minister is going to be giving this Friday in Florence. So they need to make sure that whatever end state they've got in mind, but the routes to that are kept open through Florence and beyond.
I think one of the other arguments is about the nature of the Tory party. So some people would argue, Philip Hammond would argue, look, if we're going to beat Jeremy Corbyn, economic competence is going to be absolutely key to that. So therefore, we need to avoid kind of doing anything too radical on the Brexit front, because if that disrupted the economy, we'd lose our reputation for economic competence. And then, you know, you'd have Corbyn in number 10. Those on the other side of the argument argue, hang on a second, what is the lesson of politics in recent years is that the public are deeply unhappy with the status quo. We need to take back sufficient control to get away from that status quo, to chart a different course. And so I think you've not only got this kind of question about what the direction of Britain should be, but this other debate about what the direction of the Tory party should be layered on top of it. What I think is fascinating as these conversations are, and wonderful to report on as they are, the worry is, we did trigger Article 50 almost 6 months ago, and therefore the clock is ticking all the time that we're having this debate. This is all things that the British side of this discussion should have settled long before we first called up Donald Tusk to say there's a letter in the post for you.
Henry, do you think there's a chance that we may leave without a deal?
I think there's a chance, but I think it's a relatively slim one still. I think, on the other hand, it's very important that the government says that they're prepared to take no deal in preference to a bad deal. That's obviously good negotiating tactics, and Mervyn King has argued very eloquently over recent weeks that the government needs to make credible plans to prepare for that. And I think James is right to warn that the civil service is in danger of not doing that, and that certainly, if over the last year we had made greater preparations for example, the independent customs arrangement, we would be in a much stronger position now about potentially not needing a transition out of the customs union or a transition in other areas. And I don't think that work has really happened, that focus has really been applied. Whether or not the creation of the Department of Exiting the European Union was a good idea, what it certainly meant was a lot of institutional disruption inside Whitehall. And that's to a degree distracted attention from the real focus on getting Britain in the right place to leave the European Union by the end of the Article 50 process.
James, obviously you talk about this Tory war. How is it all going to play out at party conference?
I think Theresa May's hope when she scheduled this speech in Florence was that she'd get the Brexit speech out of the way before party conference, and that, you know, that there would only need to be a kind of minimal amount of Brexit in her speech at conference. I think Brexit is the biggest issue in British politics. It is the biggest issue facing the government and the biggest issue dividing the Tory party. The idea that you could have a Tory conference that isn't dominated by Brexit in the current circumstances is for the birds.
Are they going to try and do that, do you think?
I think Theresa May wants to try and do that, but I think Boris Johnson's speech, for example, will be all about Britain's place in the world, which directly relates to this question. I think he is going to, in his conference speech, again, all the things he will say, he won't say it directly, but all the things he will say will indicate a Canada model, because they'll all be about, you know, what Britain can do as an independent actor on the world stage. I think the two things Theresa May must do at conference is, tonally, it must be the same tone as Florence. She can't fly to Italy and say, we love the Renaissance, we love your paintings, we are culturally European, and then turn up at Tory conference and tub thump and say that, you know, if those bureaucrats in Brussels think they're going to get the better of us, they've got another thing coming. The other thing is, I think she's got to avoid, if she is going to make this offer on the money in Florence, she's got to then avoid saying anything that appears to withdraw that or underpick that in her speech at conference.
That's exactly right. I was quite worried to read reports there are going to be two different speeches essentially delivered on the same topic. I think the Prime Minister is going to have a consistent message, and that message has got to be, well, it's got to be delivered at party conference in the same way. On the other hand, I think whatever she says at Florence, it's very unlikely that the EU27 will suddenly agree that sufficient progress has been made to talk trade. The EU understands very well that these negotiations are a lot about theatre, and they love the idea of Mr. Juncker saying to us, no, go back and redo your homework, that's not good enough, we need to have more position papers, more clarity. So I think that really almost whatever Theresa May put on the table, it's quite hard to see that the EU would suddenly decide that they're ready to start talking trade. I think that means that the German elections, whether or not the German elections will have a particularly intrinsic effect on moving the negotiations forward, we're not going to really start talking about the future relationship with Europe till probably the early new year. But that gives us some time to work out these things internally, to have these discussions. And I think James is actually absolutely right on the importance of Brexit policy, but isn't the real lesson of the last general election this June that all policy is up for grabs, right? We're now fundamentally arguing about what sort of country we want to be. Capitalism. Is the country going to be a free trading country if Labour takes control at the next general election? I think all these policy areas need to be argued again from first principles, and we're not seeing enough of that discussion.
That was James Forsyth and Henry Newman.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
Mikhail Saakashvili is a reckless narcissist, but he might just transform Ukraine, says Owen Matthews in this week's issue. Owen joins me now, along with Kim Sengupta, defence correspondent for The Independent. So, Owen, for those of us not so familiar with Eastern European politics, can you explain what Saakashvili is up to in Ukraine?
Well, one has to admit that the man has spectacular ambition. Having been president of his own country, he now wants to be president of another one. He was president of Georgia for 9 years, very controversially and spectacularly. He transformed the place very much for the good by staging a very dramatic battle against corruption, but he also got involved in a very much less successful battle against Russia, which he lost, and ended up losing two chunks of his country to Russia in 2008. Now he wants to do the first part of that trick again in Ukraine. He was invited to Ukraine in 2015 by President Petro Poroshenko to be the governor of Odessa region, and basically to come in as a new broom to crack down on the rampant corruption of Ukraine's most corrupt city. For a while, he succeeded just as spectacularly as he had in his native Georgia. Then things went rather wrong. He stepped on too many toes. He antagonized too many wealthy criminal clans on whom President Poroshenko himself depended on for his support. He was kicked out of Ukraine. He was stripped of his Ukrainian citizenship, leaving him stateless. But he did not, in classic Saakashvili style, take that lying down. Earlier this month, he forced his way back into the country and is now launching a very aggressive political campaign against Poroshenko.
And what sort of ticket is he running on?
It's basically bringing all the thieves of Ukraine to justice, which is a extremely ambitious project, to say the least. His main ideology is pro-Western, pro-EU, pro-NATO. But in practical terms, he wants to improve the life of Ukrainian citizens just by eliminating all the class of thieves and rogues who rule them.
Kim, you've just been in Ukraine. How is Saakashvili's power play going down there?
I came back a day earlier than I thought. In fact, I was going to stay on in Kiev to await Saakashvili, who was going to make a march on Kiev like Mussolini's march on Rome from west of the country near Lviv, where he is at the moment. But that didn't happen. We had the chief prosecutor, Yuri Lutsenko, the latest Ukrainian chief prosecutor, saying that he will not be charged with anything, neither will his supporters, apart from the ones who beat up some border guards when they came from Poland into Ukraine earlier this month, as Owen said. I am personally a bit more sceptical of Saakashvili. I was in Georgia during the Russia-Georgia war, and due to bad map reading on my part, myself and my colleague Sean Walker ended up in South Ossetia, which is one of the separatist places, along with Abkhazia, which Saakashvili lost. And after the first bit of, the separatists threatening to shoot me and Sean, they showed us around, and there was certainly evidence, it seemed, that the Georgians were not the pure victims, as Saakashvili has been claiming, that they had carried out acts of provocation, aggression against South Ossetia. But of course, you know, to what extent, we do not know. But there are also other things, like I remember being in a place called Gori when Saakashvili in Tbilisi, the capital, was claiming that the Russians had taken over Gori and were carrying out atrocities when, in fact, the Russians hadn't arrived in Gori. So I don't know Saakashvili that well, I hasten to add, but I've always been a bit more sceptical of him. And just one other thing, you know, I'm not sure how robust his opposition to Putin is. Remember, 2 years after the Russia-Georgia war, I interviewed him on the day that there was a terrorist attack in Moscow, on the Moscow airport. And Saakashvili said, you know, the last time I met Putin, I said, Vladimirovich, he had been exporting violence everywhere, and then one day he's going to come back and bite you. And Putin said, if they ever dare to attack us in Russia, we shall crush them like ants. So I wrote up this anecdote for my paper. And then the phone calls one got from the Georgian Foreign Ministry and from Saakashvili's office, and they're terrified by how Putin might react to what seemed to me to be a fairly innocuous observation. So I just wonder also, you know, just how really staunch he is in opposing his stronger enemies.
Oh, and do you think that's fair, that we should be fairly sceptical of Saakashvili?
Yes. I mean, I'm not sure that Kim really is more sceptical of Saakashvili than I, because I also strongly share those reservations. And one of the fascinating things about Saakashvili as a personality and as a politician, and something that makes him absolutely fascinating and unique, not just in Eastern Europe, but probably in the world, is the very strange mixture of admiration and skepticism that he inspires. Because Kim's exactly right. I was also in Ukraine at that time during the war, and Saakashvili would, you know, regularly just, you know, lie to me, to the rest of correspondents, you know, barefacedly about the beginning of the 2008 war, which indeed was provoked by his own recklessness. I think that he's undoubtedly a showman. He's undoubtedly, like many people who are absolutely convinced of their own right, has a rather Jesuitical attitude to the truth that ends justify means. He believes himself firmly to be on the side of the angels, and his good intentions pave the road to you know where, potentially. The problem is with Saakashvili, and the reason why I ultimately actually think that he has to succeed is that, or he should succeed, is that the promise that he's offering, that he offered his people first in Georgia and now he's offering his adopted people in Ukraine, is basically the same, premised on the same thing that the West has been offering Eastern Europe ever since the fall of communism. And that is an equation between getting rid of corruption, playing by the rules of creating a law-based society, and promising the people that that will lead to prosperity. Now, there have been several revolutions against the corrupt old post-communist order in Kiev in 2004 and again in 2013-14. It happened in Georgia in 2003-04 as well. People rose up against their corrupt rulers, threw them out, and installed new anti-corruption politicians, basically trying to realize that sort of Western dream of a post-communist society that was fair and equitable and was not run by kleptocratic thieves. In all those cases, all those revolutions failed. They just ended up collapsing into business as usual, into corruption and so on. So if Saakashvili can't succeed in Ukraine, then more or less no one can. I mean, the alternative to the kind of admittedly rather radical vision that he presents is just the sort of muddling through and the thievery which the old order of Poroshenko represents. So skepticism, yes, but I think actually he is fundamentally on the side of the angels, and the values that he represents, albeit highly imperfectly, are ones that we should strongly support.
Well, I couldn't agree more with Owen, the need to tackle endemic entrenched corruption in Ukraine is essential. Very little has been done, and I look back when we are covering the Maidan, you know, the aspirations and the hopes of the people who were very brave and many made sacrifices, and then again, you know, covering the fighting in the East, Ukraine, and, you know, the Ukrainians who are fighting the Russian separatists had this vision of a modern, you know, egalitarian society. And in the ensuing, 3 years now, there's been very little change when it comes to tackling graft. And each time I and my colleagues go back to Ukraine, it is quite depressing to see how little has been done. So in that regard, I think Owen is absolutely right that, there needs to be, massive radical surgery in Ukraine when it comes to corruption. And that is meant to be happening because the tranches of money the IMF keep handing out to Ukraine, keeping it afloat basically, is meant to be on the stipulation that Poroshenko's government tackles corruption, and they haven't. Now, whether Saakashvili wins or not, I simply don't know. His popularity is not very high, it's about 2%. But then again, Poroshenko's is around 8%. So you've got a deeply disillusioned society. And, I think the fact that Saakashvili has brought in a platform, or rather is acting on a platform of anti-corruption, is a good thing. But then again, having said that, it's a question of who he allies himself with. He appeared at a rally with Yulia Tymoshenko, who herself has been accused quite rightly of corruption. So I think, he may find it difficult to find allies in Ukraine who are not corrupt.
That was Owen Matthews and Kim Sengupta. Why wait for tomorrow's papers? The best analysis of the day's news is already on Coffee House. To subscribe to the Evening Blend email in order to receive the best of The Spectator each day, just head to spectator.co.uk/blend. Finally, on to cricket. In this week's issue of The Spectator, Henry Blofeld writes about the hectic business of retiring from commentating on Test Match Special. Henry joins me now. So Henry, how is retirement treating you?
Well, it's not really a retirement for me, because after all, I've now spent about 120 nights a year in the theatre. I've only been doing about 5 Test matches a year for the last 4 or 5 years. So I'm only really protecting myself or giving myself 30 extra days, which will be absorbed rapidly indeed. But it's been the most exciting time, this retirement. I never thought, when I announced it on the 23rd of June, I just thought I'd disappear over the horizon in the fullness of time, instead of which it's been quite extraordinary. And I've been amazed and thunderstruck by, I think, the affection people have for me. It was amazing, and it all came to a head, really, in that extraordinary last day of the recent third test against the West Indies and Lords, when I walked round the ground and something like 30,000 people gave me a standing ovation, which went on for about half an hour. Extraordinary.
Was it a fairly emotional day?
Well, yes, I'm not that sort of emotional guy, actually. I knew it was my last day, and I can become quite dispassionate about these things and detach myself, because I think then it becomes a bit untidy. There were one or two others who were blubbing, but I'm not really quite that sort of chap. I mean, I made up my mind a long time ago that I was going to go, and I wanted to get out of it cleanly. I wanted to be at my best in my last summer, and I wanted to leave everyone feeling good about it and saying, why don't you come back rather than why haven't you gone years ago?
And Henry, what are you going to miss most about TMS?
Well, I mean, I'm going to miss the camaraderie of friends. We're a very close-knit unit, really, within the box. And, we laughed a lot together, and there were an awful lot of in-jokes, which we try and avoid it on the air. And, I mean, people like Jonathan Agnew have become great, great friends. Jonathan Agnew, Michael Vaughan, Phil Tufnell, Vic Marks, Graham Swan, tremendous friends. And, I'm on the telephone to them all the time. I still will be. I shall miss the fact of not going to a commentary box and not working, I suppose, with time will tell. I don't think I should go and watch cricket when I've got nothing to do with it, because then I think I may get bored. I know that sounds silly, but one of the great joys of commentating is you go to a ground and you can communicate, you can try and get it across however many millions or hundreds of thousands are listening, and that is a great sort of impetus for you. But I don't think I would want to go there and just sit there and watch without anything to do. I think probably I would turn around, fill up my glass, and watch an awful lot of the cricket, talking to a chum with a full glass, rapidly emptying in my hand.
When you were in the commentator's box, did you ever have a favourite configuration of commentators?
Well, no, I didn't. You work with everyone and you get on with everyone. I think that's one of the great secrets of Test Match Special. it's a combination of voices, different voices, different styles, different everything. And you adapt, and you've got a newcomer comes in. You see, I'm a commentator, and none of the other commentators, like Jonathan Agnew, Simon Mann, and the others, Ed Smith, Charlie Dagnall, Dan Norcross, I don't work with any of them. They succeed me, or I lead on from them. The people I work with are the summarizers, like Vaughan Tufnell, Boycott, Mick Marks, and the others. And you get on with all of them in their different ways. Everyone's different. And as a commentator, you've got to watch and try and learn how and why people are different, and indeed what makes them tick. I mean, there's all the difference in the world, for instance, between Fred Truman and Geoffrey Boycott, in a way. I know they're both very strong Yorkshiremen, but in point of fact, they were as different from one another as chalk and cheese, in my view.
And obviously, Henry, you've been doing TMS for a long time now. How has it changed since when you started commentating?
Well, I think it's become less disciplined, in a way. And you may say, in a way, it's become less formulaic. We had certain rules. I mean, giving the score, people will always say you don't give the score enough. Why do they say that? Because when you turn on, the first thing you want to know is the score. Well, now, we go all over the world, and so you may be certain that just about every split second someone's turning on. Well, you can't be going on giving the score non-stop. Therefore, if people are going to say constantly you're not giving the score enough. But in the old days, we had a sort of unwritten rule that you gave the score and the side score and the two individual scores of the non-out batsman at the end of every over. When a run was scored, you gave the side score and the individual score of the batsman who scored the run. And then, after three balls when nothing had happened, and it looked like going on to a maiden over, you then gave the score again then. And I don't think this discipline still really applies, because that special commentary has become very much more conversational. I think makes it more accessible in a way. I'm not criticizing it in the least, but I mean, when Aggers and Big Marks are together, it's brilliant. They are chatting away. They break off when Aggers describes the ball. If nothing much has happened, they go on back to the conversation. And I think it's a very, very good way of communicating it all. But that is a way in which it has changed. And it also meant, as far as I was concerned, this continuous conversation. I mean, try and keep Michael Vaughan and Geoffrey Boycott quiet for two balls. It's difficult enough. But for a whole over, it's starkly impossible. So it meant that I had less chance to do what I'm perhaps any good at, which is describing things, painting the picture. And that, therefore, made it a little bit harder for me. And I think I found, I mean, overall, I'm going to be 78 today, too. I'm nearly 100, it's awful. I think I found that it wasn't quite so easy. And if something isn't quite so easy, it becomes, ergo, less fun. And if it's less fun, well, do you really want to go on doing it, having done it for 47 years?
I suppose something else that's changed is obviously the BBC. I mean, do you think nowadays you would get a job working at the BBC if you were starting out?
No doubt that I wouldn't. I happen to have a sort of old-fashioned accent, don't I? It's an era of the regional accent. And also, I do it in a way, I came into it as an amateur, certainly. I came into it when individuality was encouraged. People like Don Arlott, Brian Johnston, would they get in today? I don't know. I rather doubt it. I think today there is a levelling up from the bottom rather than the steeples at the top, which indicate individuality. And I think everyone tries initially to be the same rather than going out on a limb and being themselves. And I always say to everyone who says to me, what is the secret of commentary, is be yourself. But I'm not sure that that's what happens today. I think people are more inclined in the age in which we live to be like everyone else rather than to be themselves.
That seems a shame to me. And just finally, at the last count, I think it was revealed that 52% of your listeners were female. Why do you think TMS is so popular with the ladies?
Well, I mean, you asked that question. I wonder if you yourself ever listened to it, because TMS is not about cricket, really. It's about everything in life. We talk about anything and everything. And listeners send us cakes. We talk about what we were doing last night. We talk about theatres. It's in amongst the cricket. We are taking the covers off and unfolding cricket stories, certainly. But we're also doing so much more. And housewives, I was talking to someone last night, up there in Nottingham, listen to four ladies who listen person all the time while they're doing their housework, because they love a comfortable, relaxed voice, and they love all the little extra details we give about life, really. They're not particularly interested in the intricacies of playing a forward defensive stroke or whatever, but they love the general chat, the humour, and the joie de vivre, which I think we give off in plenty, really.
That was Henry Blofeld. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes Store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And you can also subscribe to our other shows, including Holy Smoke, our religion podcast hosted by Damian Thompson and Christina Adoni. This week, they're talking to Jeremy Vine about Christians on Twitter. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed, as well as great pieces by Marina Wheeler, Sarah Sands and Rory Sutherland. And we've got a special offer for podcast listeners. You can get 12 issues for just £12, as well as a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook, if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.